Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, October 1st, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. Time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. And I'll give that information out again when I invite your participation in about 15 minutes. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta. John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com. And Miles Elam, programmer and student of American Literature. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before we start taking people's calls, though, if you'd like to get in the queue, you're welcome to do so. You can do that by going to geekspeak.org and clicking on Contact Us to get into our email queue. Or you can call us in about 10 minutes, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Before we start taking calls, we're going to do some geek news. And I think today I will start with Mr. Elam.
Seeing as how we're broadcasting from Santa Cruz, it seems to make a lot of sense to talk about. The biggest mushroom in the world, or sorry, the biggest mushroom in Europe was recently discovered.
How many kilometers?
It's 86 acres.
86?
Or rather, it's a fungus.
Uh-huh.
But 86 acres in size, believed to be about 1,000 years old. And it's mostly
one old mushroom.
Yes, it's. Now, this does not say it's the largest. The largest one in the world is actually located in Oregon, which and that fungus covers 2,200 acres.
And basically what they do is they take a probe and they look at the genetic makeup of the organism at one location and another location and say, oh, that's the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Can you believe that? A single organism that's 2,200 acres large.
It's impressive. I got to say, that's really impressive. Thank you, Miles, for that.
That's going to take a lot of butter to fry up.
John?
Speaking of fungus, war driving conviction is the first person convicted under CAN spam. Now, they're using the term war driving here, but okay, let me go on with the story. Nicholas Tombros has admitted to driving around Venice, California last year, searching for unprotected hotspots and exploiting them to distribute unsolicited email that advertised pornographic websites. So he's basically driving around looking for open wireless connections and then using those open wireless connections to get in and start sending spam.
Now, is he sending spam from his own machine through that open wireless connection
point? It doesn't get that detailed into it.
Okay. And why was he convicted?
Under the CAN Spam Act of 2003, that's illegal.
You have to send spam from a kind of authenticated location.
Exactly. Right.
Did he get caught? I mean, did the police officer go, hey?
They don't talk about how they caught him because, you know, yeah, you can't really do that.
He probably used his return email address or something.
But I just want to say that he is not really a war driver because the motto of the war driver is drive, detect, defend, not drive, detect, exploit. Nicholas Tombros, you're a bad person.
Hence the conviction.
He's going to be sentenced December 6th, and it is the first person convicted under the 2003 CAN Spam Act.
What can he face?
It doesn't say. No.
Sean? Thank you, John. Mr. Cleveland.
Next time I'll get a longer article.
So Schwarzenegger has signed a bunch of bills this week, and one of them...
Our governor?
Yes, our illustrious governor.
Sure which
governor. Thank you.
Governor. And he signed the anti-spyware bill. And what this bill combats is malware and spyware. Basically, anybody who plants on personal computers, any deceptive type of software that can capture keystrokes or launch viruses, any sort of software like that.
Sean, from your cursory look at this bill, do you like it or not?
Well, spyware expert Ben Edelman said that it is the most superfluous of all legislation and that it lacks teeth. So probably an expert in the field, I would guess, as he's named as such. It doesn't sound like it's really going to do a whole lot.
All right.
I'm not quite sure how they're going to, you know, how they're going to back this bill. I just don't see how they're going to
right.
go after people.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially software. A lot of the software that has these packages in there, that's, the software is free. And so it's kind of like, what are you attacking? You're not attacking a financial source. It's hard to get the person.
Yeah.
Well, good. Now, Schwarzenegger did another bill or two this week as well. John, I think you have a story about another bill that...
Yeah, he signed in the e-voting paper trail bill, which basically says that it'll go into effect in the 2006 primaries, which basically states that any electronic voting machine has to have a paper trail.
Later this month, we're going to have a whole show on electronic voting machines, a suggestion from one of our listeners, and we're getting an expert on the software, and we're looking into how the technology works. Pretty interesting. I think I'm looking forward to that show. It'll probably be in the later part of October.
And he did away with...
Schwarzenegger.
Schwarzenegger signed another bill doing away with the loophole for vehicles that are 30 years or older. They now have to get smogged.
Now, you were upset about this because you have an old...
I have a 66 convertible Mustang. And I don't drive it very often, but it's going to be... It's going to be difficult to smog, I think.
Yeah. Now, all three of you geeks here, Sean, John, and Miles, all have Priuses. Priuses. So you're pretty fuel efficient, I would say. Now, Sean, how can you have a Prius on one hand and a big gas-guzzling American Mustang on the other?
Well, the Mustang's more just a collectability. And
he likes the smell of burning rubber.
Well, it smells like roses. It really does. But when I take it out, on the weekend, you know, it's more of a fun car. You know, I don't drive it every day. I drive my Prius every day.
Okay.
But it's going to be difficult to get that thing smogged, I think.
Well, it's probably a good thing for clean air in California to have these cars not have a loophole in them.
Yeah.
John, you're...
I could get...
From an understanding, it's there's so few cars and people take care of them like they're a baby. They're not driven enough to make an impact.
It's what they're trying to do is close a hole in the law that says you have to smog your car unless it's beyond a certain age. There are some cars, you know, the old beater cars that people are still using. You know, unfortunately, these are people who can't afford to go out and buy a new car, maintain the car to keep it going that way. You're right, though. The majority of historically collected cars that people have, you know, restored or maintained, they're going to pass the smog probably with no problem because they maintain them.
Well, no. They probably won't because they're older.
They don't have catalytic converters, for example.
But they're not being driven enough that...
Aren't they doing a provision that's... Because I know right now the law states that if your car is this many years old, you have this allowance of pollutants that it can create.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a gradient scale on that.
You need to find out a little bit
about that. Well, it used to be, before this law was changed, before the loophole was closed, that past a certain age, I forget what the exact year was, sometime in the 70s, I believe.
75?
That basically the cars were exempt. They didn't have to be smogged at all. There's no emissions control on them at all.
And that has been changed.
Yeah.
We're going to go off to Miles now, since you're talking anyway, sir.
You guys are going to love this one. Some folks are working on...
Sound like a marketing
person.
Yeah. You're going to love this.
Anyone who tells you that is trying to sell you something. Go ahead.
Nuclear micro batteries.
Yes.
You have a whole bunch of people going like, what? Oh, no, great. Now you want to put a nuclear reactor in my cell phone.
I read a great story on this at Spectrum Magazine, a great, wonderful magazine, discussing how these things work. And
actually, it's an article that I'm reading right in front of me, yes. it's basically not talking about putting a full nuclear reactor. It's talking about very small elements, either nickel or tritium isotopes, that the amount of nuclear power particles that they emit is actually on par or lower than what you would get in a smoke detector, for example, the americium that's in it.
Right. And the way they use it is pretty interesting. You vibrate a metal plate above the material by the discharge of the high-frequency particles rip electrons off the plate above it, and therefore it gets a positive charge and gets attracted to the lower part. And as that vibration happens...
That was one of them, the cantilever design. Yeah.
As it happens, it disturbs a piezoelectric crystal, and you get small power. And we're talking really small power,
right.
Trickle
it
current.
Yeah, it wouldn't be able to power your cell phone just right off the bat. But what it could do is if you only use your cell phone for a couple of calls a day, it can trickle charge the battery constantly, which
right.
means that instead of having to charge your put their phone on the charger every 2 days or something similar to that, you could it's simply trickle charging itself for
right.
the
if
life of the phone.
If your phone sits there, it charges, basically.
Yeah, so you may have to charge it once a month.
Right. Or not at all, depending on how much you use it.
Right.
And with remote devices, things that are small transmitters that are dropped, that are attached to marine life and things of that nature, they could do a small transmit every once in a while.
So wait a minute. It emits as much radioactivity as a smoke detector?
Less, actually.
Less, yeah.
How many people hold smoke detectors to their ears for long periods of time?
It should, but the types of particles
I mean, give me,
will
give
penetrate
me some sort of a comparison that, makes sense.
Okay, I'll put it this way.
That's
the,
in context.
The particles that are emitting from this are not only less numerous than what you find in a smoke detector, but the particles would only penetrate about 25 micrometers.
Microns.
Uh-huh. Yeah, into...
of skin.
Well, into any substance.
Right.
So basically, even the plastic shielding on your phone would be enough to...
The casing of your cell phone would stop the radiation.
Yeah, okay. It's not anything on the level of a nuclear reactor or nuclear fuel or nuclear waste.
The thing that's fascinating is these things just won't be in consumer devices because people are so concerned and so scared about radioactivity.
Well, unless they change the name. If they call them go particles, as opposed to go energy, as opposed to nuclear energy.
I mean, after talking about the Cassini spacecraft, that it was nuclear powered.
Right.
And that thing's, almost halfway across the...
And people freaked out.
Our galaxy.
People were worried about the launch of it.
This stuff is in early prototyping. The potential for it is pretty interesting.
Yeah, but considering the batteries have not gotten that much better in the last 50 years,
It might be more of a technology for industrial and embedded applications.
Yeah, I would agree on that.
Embedded applications like cell phones?
Thank you, Miles, for that story.
That would be a consumer embedded... not industrial, but...
Okay.
John? Mr. Tracy?
Anyone who's been a long-time listener has heard us talking about the NSRI X Prize. It's a $10 million prize for the first individual company or corporation that can get a spaceship into space, space being the 100,000-meter mark, the 100-kilometer mark, which is the edge of space. Get it up there, safely land it, and then do it again within 14 days. First company, person, or corporation that does that gets $10 million. This Wednesday, Scale Composites, which is run by Burt Rutan, and it's down in Southern California, launched Spaceship One, their attempt, on its first flight. This is actually its second flight into space. It did one in June, which broke a bunch of history books. Broke a bunch of history books? Put it in the history books, broke some records, and it also made pilot Mike Melville the first non-NASA-affiliated astronaut.
Not in government affiliated.
Government
because they're
affiliated.
Well,
he's not. Yeah, right.
No, they're cosmonauts.
No, those are cosmonauts.
Different. Astronauts are American.
Right.
Space travel.
Astronauts are American. So he's the first
one
to get his astronaut wings who is not affiliated with NASA. So Wednesday he did his second flight, which is the first attempt at the $10 million prize, and he hit 103 kilometers above the Earth with 64 miles up, which definitely qualifies. He was actually... told to abort the mission. His craft was going into a roll, so he was told to abort the mission, but decided, what the heck, I'm up here, I might as well do it anyway.
He's not going up again.
No, he is.
He is, okay.
He is, actually. And they're planning on rolling this craft back out. They have 14 days to do it. Did it Wednesday, so that means they have two Wednesdays from now. They have to go back up. They're planning on doing it on Monday, which gives a turnaround time of about 5 days. All they have to do is take out the old engine, put a new engine in, refuel it, and off they go.
I heard this great thing about that is that, of course, they've spent a lot more than $10 million on this project.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's not
all
like
the teams have. So it's not going to pay for itself.
But it's a good incentive.
However, there is now a second prize coming up. Let me see if I can find that one really quick. Yeah, there's now a second prize coming up that's going to have a $50 million prize. And it's more of a get a spaceship up into space that can actually carry passengers to a destination.
Like
so,
the moon?
No.
No.
Like a suborbital hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Or an orbital, not suborbital.
I see. So you can
hotel.
Have your crew and some people cargo.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So it's kind of trying to be more of a, that was fun, but now for
Let's
something that really would work, here's how we can commercialize space.
Great. All right. Thank you very much, John. Sean.
SanDisk has upped the capacity of flash memory cards. Kind of cool. Their Ultra 2 Compact Flash Type 1 cards, which is a CF Type 1, will top out at 8 gigabytes. Are we talking prices?
No.
Yeah, I got a
rough ballpark.
Yeah, rough ballpark. Under 100 bucks?
About 10 times that.
Wow.
They'll also be available in 4 gigabyte and lower capacities. Ultra 2 Memory Stick Pro cards will max out at 4 gigabytes, cost roughly the same amount as the 8 gigabyte CF card. And there will be Secure Digital Cards, SD, now up to 2 gigabytes in size.
We got some people online on the phone that have been waiting patiently while we're going through news. So we'll try to scatter news throughout the show, but I'm going to go ahead and take David's call from Santa Cruz. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I have a question concerning consistency or lack thereof of home-burnt CDs, not sure what you would call them, self-burned.
Personal CDs, uh-huh.
Pardon?
Go on.
And I want to emphasize that this is not pirated music. This is, I went into a friend's fairly nicely equipped studio, recorded four tunes, and I'm fairly very new at in this area.
But we are talking about audio CDs.
Audio, yes.
Uh-huh. So you've got these audio CDs that you made, and you're trying to share them with people and play them on other things.
And getting seems to me a very low consistency rate. And I also want to emphasize that there are a number of generations. These are not all coming from the same CD burner,
right?
At least four.
Are we talking about inconsistencies on which types of players can play it? Or you play it once in a player and you play it later in that same player and it acts differently?
Actually, one instance of the latter, but mostly the former.
Okay. Well, newer CD players will work better.
Yes, that much I've gathered.
And that's pretty clear, and that just has to do with the technology has been improving and such.
Yeah, certain media will work better than others. I remembered seeing a listing of either the manufacturers or the type of CDs that would work better, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Well, one person said Memorex tended to be much more consistent, and the Memorex version that I have is about as inconsistent as all the others.
I don't know if I believe that. But you know, one thing I know that does affect the readable quality of the CD, and that's what's important here, is that that it's imprinted very deeply, if you will. The things are burned, the holes are burned clearly, and that is to decrease the burn speed. If you have a burner that's a 12-speed burner, for example, go ahead and decrease that down to 6-speed. It's going to take twice as long to burn.
Right.
But theoretically, the laser is on during that part of the disc for a longer period of time, and therefore we'll get a cleaner burn through.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But, you know, that's a good theory, but I haven't seen any study.
No, I have actually seen this before, with especially when older drivers are trying to read it.
Even when we talked to that digital, I forget his name, when we talked to that digital...
That marketing guy, yeah.
Yeah, the expert. Uh-huh. Actually, no, he was the guy who wrote the book for O'Reilly.
Oh, yes, right.
And
right.
He said that that doesn't make a difference. Laser's a laser.
It's
getting the same amount of power. Disc is spinning faster, but I tend to think... I agree with these guys. I think if you burn at a lower rate, it does increase compatibility.
I agree.
It couldn't hurt anyway.
Yeah. No, it couldn't hurt. Now, so the next thing is, let's say you've got your disc, and then there has to do with the different types of dye. Basically, the dye itself is the thing that reflects the beam back, and that's what gets burned through, if you will. And some of the colors of dyes are better at reflecting back than others. And you can't fix that at all from the burning speed, because it's actually the reflective part of it. So what you and that's where it comes into choices. So it's much less, I think, who the manufacturer is and much more of the color of the disc, if you will. But there's a myriad of colors, and it has to do with what reflective top they have versus what color dye they have. So
and there are CDRs that say that they're made for audio. I can't say whether or not they make a difference or not.
They cost more.
I know they cost more, but...
And the reason they cost more is a legislative matter. Basically, the body that controls music in the world decided that if you're going to have audio CDs, they should get a cut of some money off of it. So
well, no, that's actually all CDs. All CDRs have
all CDRs
have that tax. So the audio ones, it's more of a marketing thing rather than a legal thing.
So, David, I would suggest burning at half the speed, and then do try. Like, if you can, if you've got a couple different types of media, go ahead and do that. And then when you run across a disk, a drive that doesn't read it very well, try all three of your, try the different types of media, specifically the dye color. and see which one works better. There's a lot of discussion on this online, but mostly it is fluff, and you can't really decipher anything from it. So the next thing about the inconsistency on the same drive, now, that's a little more complicated. What else? You got any suggestions on that one?
Not off the top of my head. No. Inconsistency on the same
There's drive. A great site I just found. It's called Media Sciences. It's all about computer media quality.
Is that a hyphen or... One
no, it's www.mscience.com, and it's got a lot of things, you know, like why do discs fail and how to, defect. It's got a lot of good stuff about different CDs and how to judge if a CD is good quality.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I just want to make sure you are burning AIFF and not MP3s.
Oh, yes, okay. Definitely.
Yeah. I assumed you were, but I just wanted to put that out there. A lot of times when people make a disc from a computer, they put it under MP3 and then try to play it on players.
You've got to say, a lot of times, mostly the burner.
The ones that I have burnt myself are using Nero software, and I just choose audio, which I presume is not doing it as an MP3.
Right. One thing that a Nero does have is a skip on error, meaning that even if it has an error that happens, it might skip it. On a data CD, on any CD, it's not actually a good thing to skip the error. Most of the time, the errors are not going to really affect the media. But one thing you could do is say, don't skip on error. Make sure that checkbox is unchecked. And that way, you know, if a burn happens and the disc is not good, you'll know about it, instead of making a disc that's kind of pseudo-okay and then maybe skips during the song.
Okay. So one, just as a sort of percentages thing, I would say that most of the CDs, and again, you know, like four different generations, three or four different burners, I play very consistently on console type or, you know, stereo system type players. 75% or less on computers and or boombox type players. And is that expecting too much, basically, is what I'm... I appreciate all your information to try to improve it. But
I don't think it's expecting too much. No, I think that's how it should work. I mean, they should work everywhere. But whether that's reality...
Well, yeah, okay, give me the not should be, but am I getting a lower rate than your average person?
You know, I don't test my burn so much, but I can't think of the last time something I burned didn't work.
But that's data CDs, and you're reading...
No, audio.
Audio.
Oh, yeah, audiobooks.
Yeah.
I use them.
Yeah, it's true.
They play
so
everywhere.
You play them, you'll take them to a friend's and play them on a boombox, play them on their computer,
You know what, though? One of Sean's CDs that he made for me, an audio CD of that nature, during the later part of the disc, when the data is traveling faster, doesn't work in my car.
And that's part of the...
So there's...
That was the MP3.
There are players, you know. There's
no, Lyle, that was the MP3.
Yeah, but...
Blank spot.
What I get is virtually every one.
Clash of Kingsford.
And I've done at least 20, from other people burned and copies of the wave files that I burned as audios. Virtually they're all the same in terms of not playing on less than 75% of computers and boomboxes.
I would say that's probably consistent with what people run into.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we're going to go ahead and go right into another call from Santa Cruz. Dana, welcome to Geek Speak. Well, actually, I'll switch over to Dana because that would... allow us to talk to Dana.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. My question?
Yes.
Was I'm considering buying an Apple PowerBook laptop, and I've been running a G4, you know, from 99, and it's, you know, probably time to get a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And that my old computer held a gig of memory, and the new one's held 2 gigs. And I was wondering if it was worth spending the extra $500 to, you know, instead of getting maybe like 1.5, getting the 2, you know.
What kind of applications do you generate?
I run, Photoshop.
Photoshop.
Illustrator,
Photoshop core. Always likes to have more memory.
Yeah, Dreamweaver and Flash. I'm getting into that some more. And I've never ever had a low memory with this current. You know, I'm running 10 on, you know, running Panther on the G4 now.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, like a 67 megahertz. I'm going to be jumping up to 1.5.
With,
you know?
With OS 10, you won't get low memory errors ever.
Oh.
You could run it, 128 megs of RAM, and you wouldn't get any errors.
You just get a really
slow
system.
You just get slower. The more memory you have, especially in like Photoshop, the faster the machine will run when doing things in Photoshop.
Okay.
So it depends on what your time's worth.
A lot.
then it would be worth it.
Stack it up.
So you would, yeah, okay.
One thing to pay attention to when you do are buying this new laptop, it will come with some memory. And you might even be able to say, Apple, give me, you know, stack it full of a gig. But they might necessarily give you that in one stick. They'll probably give it in two sticks, and then you've got a problem.
Yeah.
Because there's still only two slots in a PowerBook.
Right.
And if you have, like, you know, 512 and 512, you can't put more than a gig in there without getting new memory. So really take a look at that.
Yeah.
All laptops will only take half that. Also, your laptop from your G4 tower will not fit in your laptop. I mean, the memory from the G4 will not fit.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to get rid of it. I'm just going to keep it as a backup. I already discussed with them. I called one and got a quote, and, you know, there's a promotion right now where they're giving you a free 512, but it won't matter if you want to go to 2 gigs because the two slots.
You will not be unhappy, Dana, getting more memory for your laptop.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
She sounds like she already had her mind made up anyway.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. The Geeks this morning, Sean, Miles, and John, and myself, we're all standing by to take your calls and questions. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Visit geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us, and we'll get that email from you. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301.
This week on This American Life, a reporter gets on a plane. The guy in the seat next to him is wearing, no kidding, a Superman costume. And yes, people keep asking the Superman guy, can you just fly there without the airplane? Turns out the guy decided one day that life was just too short not to do exactly what he wanted. And what he wanted many days was to dress just like Superman. Some people find it charming. That story and other tales of how to win friends and influence people this week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
Affordable Housing Advocates presents a Santa Cruz City Council Candidates Forum on housing issues on Monday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at the London Nelson Community Center. For information, call 426-4272.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell, the Geeks This Morning. That was Miles Elam. John Tracy and Sean Cleveland are also here. We're taking your calls, questions, and comments about technology, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can send us a message by visiting geekspeak.org. Miles?
Actually, I have a question just from the earlier story when we were talking about nuclear batteries. What is the proper pronunciation, micrometer or micrometer?
I think micrometer sounds like a device.
It sounds like what you use to measure micrometers.
Yeah.
But it's kilometer.
Yeah.
Although some people say kilometer, but a lot of times it's just kilometer.
It's just a micro.
Way to evade.
Amber from Seaside, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. Just to address this question, I listen to BBC a lot, and I noticed that some of the announcers say kilometer, and I had always thought it was kilometer, so I don't think it really matters. I think it's just usage, individual usage.
It depends on scientific you want to sound, I think.
Exactly.
Nuclear versus nuclear.
Yeah, and, you know, they've used the meter system for far longer than we have.
It's pronounced a kilo.
That's true.
Well, my question is this. I'm running Windows 98, and I have on my desktop, among the things I have, are RealPlayer, QuickTime Player, CD Player, Sound Recorder, RealPort Audio.
Now, you're not bragging about this, are you?
The Windows Media Player. Well, no, I don't know. I have no idea what, you know, if they're similar or whether I need them all. I don't know how they even got there, really.
Are you on a Windows machine?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I can answer one of them. Windows Media Player came with your operating system.
Okay.
But why is it on the desktop?
Because
Microsoft
wants me to use it. Okay.
Uh-huh. Well, I put them all there. I mean, I went down the list of things, and I just made, you know, shortcuts to the desktop for a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I want to start doing some recording and, you know, storing some music on my hard drive and such and burning some, making some custom CDs of my own. And I'm just wondering, are these basically all the same, or does one offer more features than the other? Because I'd like to, you know, concentrate on one and become proficient in, you know, the one that offers me the most.
Well, Geeks, do you have any opinions on different media players?
It's hard because almost every site you go to requires one or the other of the media players. So it depends on what kind of media you tend to view and what sites you tend to go to.
Oh, I see.
Some of them use QuickTime, some of them use Windows Media, some of them use RealPlayer. So it really depends on where you go as to what you can see.
Oh, so they are distinctive. I mean, it's not like a generic.
Right.
To some degree, they're extinctive.
Yeah. But some can read the other.
RealPlayer can play basically any media text. It's going through basically the same engine that Windows Media Player is, just the Windows. But at the same time, a lot of people don't like having to deal with a RealPlayer. But it doesn't really affect it. I mean,
yeah, it's all about compatibility of the player.
I don't know about other file types. Like QuickTime movie files are very much a QuickTime player thing, aren't they?
Yeah, I got to say, unless it's a .rm RealPlayer file, yeah, you have to use RealPlayer. .avi is QuickTime, Media. Or excuse me, that's Windows Media. .mov is QuickTime. I use QuickTime to play those files, and I use Windows Media Player to play everything else.
So as I go into each program, it sort of would tell me what if what I'm using wouldn't work or what.
If you're on a Windows machine, and you give a, if you're offered a bunch of selections, you're almost better off going with Windows Media Player every time, unless it's a QuickTime file.
Oh, okay.
Or unless you have to because it's RealPlayer. But if it's RealPlayer, you won't be given a choice. So
right.
You'll know.
So there's the thing. You need three players, basically. You need QuickTime, you need Real, and you need something else that plays everything else. And Windows Media is good because it actually plays Windows.
And don't
Media
get files. Duped into buying any of those.
Don't buy any of them. They're all free.
They're all free.
Oh, yeah.
You just
I
have to search for the...
Yeah. On the
with RealPlayer, it's very difficult to find the free player.
The good news is,
they
want
to sell you a more advanced player.
The good news is you can remove all the shortcuts from your desktop.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It'll always just automatically launch the application.
Yeah, well, the RealPlayer, I think whenever I have tried to open it up, they say that I need a download, and then they want some money, and I haven't really paid any money.
You can find the free one online.
If you click on your Start button in Windows, and then right above or right below Control Panel is Set Program Access and Defaults. That's where you set your player, the default player setting.
Okay.
She's running 98.
I don't know if that's in Windows 98. That was added later in an update. So
okay.
Thank you, Amber, for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
From Atescadero, Gary, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
First, I appreciate you taking my call and the fact that you guys are just so knowledgeable. I can only understand about a tenth of what you say. I'm not that informed. And
you're assuming we're making sense.
Well, do you say tomato or tomato?
Stop making sense.
My question is, and again, you know, you have to understand, I don't know that much. So I'm going to ask the question and just get off the air so I can hear more clearly on the radio, if that's okay with you guys. But I was wondering if when I'm on a chat, or in my particular case, referencing Yahoo chat, I've been warned by other people that if I respond to PMs, you know, private messages, that that somehow opens me up to the person that I respond to be able to somehow get into my machine using my IP address or whatever source information they can get from my emailing to them. Is that possible that they can take the information that is in the source of my machine and somehow get into my machine without my permission of any sort?
It's not necessarily a straightforward issue. What will happen is a lot of times you'll be either on a chat list, or someone will simply just try different combinations of Yahoo addresses to go for an instant messenger connection. But unless you're making a direct connection,
right,
no one can put any data forth to your system. You don't have to really worry about exploits to your system, per se.
Through IM.
But at the same time, for example, if you're using Yahoo Instant Messenger, if someone is just looking to see who's out there and sends some message from a bot that makes it seem like there's a real person there, if you respond, then there's a good chance that an email address of that same Yahoo ID is going to be active as well, and it could be a source for people to send you spam.
Now, that said, basically, and I just want to clarify, you're not really in danger, but your data is visible.
The data that you're sending through the AIM client is visible. So as you're editing stuff and you're doing send, especially if you're on a wireless network, people within the communication lines between the two points can actually look at the data you're sending. It's kind of hard to do, but they can do it.
Well, let's qualify that, because I think that might scare folks. That's not... It's clearing text so someone could listen to your Yahoo, for example, conversation or AOL conversation. It's not looking at all your data on your hard drive.
Right.
Sorry.
It's just the communication you send through that media.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Vaguely, yeah. I'm taping this, so I'm going to review it and see what you
said. So basically, Gary, what happens whenever you type through an instant messenger client, or most of them, there are some that do secure, but almost all of them do open. It means that the message, same with email actually, are being transferred through Ethernet protocols, through the Internet, in an unencrypted manner. So if you're a system admin or you have access to look at or sniff the pipes, if you will, those communication lines, you can actually see the data being sent. It's hard to do. It's complicated.
It's kind of like a good analogy is if you're talking to someone on the telephone, that's not encrypted.
Right.
If somebody could actually put a listening device on that line and listen in.
Someone could be on the telephone pole tapping into your phone line and listening. It's possible.
Yeah, I think an easier analogy I think for the audience would be it's kind of like when you put your mail out for people to be delivered.
It is a lot like this. Yeah.
The postman, picks it up, or postwoman, picks it up, takes it down to the post office. Then it's sifted by other people, and anyone in that chain
could.
Although
open it
in general, we trust them, but anyone in that chain could, look at it. Or if it's a postcard, for example, read what you've written.
Right.
Very much Yahoo Instant Messenger and email is very much like a postcard.
That said, I have used an AIM client, open communication client like that, sending passwords. I think I've even sent a credit card through it one once. It's so unlikely that someone's going to be looking at it.
What an idiot.
I'm not concerned. And my Ethernet address at home is no. So thank you very much for the call.
All right, thank you.
And, we got more calls, so we're just going to keep on going. From Salinas, David, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a problem with a refurbished handheld that I bought.
Okay, a Palm?
A Palm 3, I think, is that how I said?
3? Okay, Palm 3?
Yeah.
All right.
I can't hot sync it. And every time I try, the handheld says, connecting between your handheld computer and the desktop cannot be established.
Okay. Does anything happen on your computer, like a little window pop-up or anything happen on the computer when you push the button?
One of the problems when I press the hot sync manager, nothing happens.
Okay.
It doesn't come up.
Are you connecting your little cradle that holds your palm or the cable that connects to your palm, is that connected while you're doing this?
Yes.
And it's connected to the computer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next thing is maybe your software is not installed in the computer anymore. Can you open up Hot Sync Manager inside your computer? Can you run that application?
No, I think that might be a problem. Every time I click on Hot Sync Manager, nothing comes up on the computer.
Okay. You need to reinstall Hot Sync Manager. Now, do you currently use the Palm desktop and such to manage your contact information on your computer, or are you using something like Outlook or something else?
No, just I'm not using Outlook. No.
And is that thing working? That when you can you look at your message, your calendar, and your address book on your computer?
That part works. Yeah.
Okay. So all you need to do is reinstall the conduit, the syncing part of it, which is the conduit manager. And you're on a Windows machine.
Right. Windows.
Okay. To do that is a little dangerous because you don't want to erase your old data. But I wouldn't really worry about that much because your Palm device the most up to date right now, or is your computer the most up to date right now?
What do you mean?
Well, you have contract address book stuff
in
your computer.
Where's the newest information?
Yeah, you have it on your computer, and you also have it in your palm.
Well, right now I don't have no information on either.
Oh, great. Just install your palm stuff again, and you'll have no problems.
And if you don't have a disk, you can go up to palm.com and look around, and it's a free download from up there.
Yeah. So basically, you put your cradle in, you connect everything up, make sure that cradle's powered. If it has an external power source, make sure it has that.
Uh-huh.
And then you want to install the software for the device.
I tried to install it twice, and I still can't get...
And do you have any error messages when you're installing?
Yeah, I followed all the messages, but I just still... Every time I click on Hot Sync Manager, nothing comes up.
All right, I would call Palm at this point. They actually have pretty good tech support on this kind of thing.
Okay.
They'll have a great database of things they can choose and find out what's going on in your system, and they're probably better set to answer this question than we are.
Is there a way I can get it on Internet?
Yeah, Palm's site will have a support area. You can definitely do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call, David. And we're going to go now to Mark, somewhere on Highway 9. Highway 17. Mark, are you driving currently?
You know, I'm not.
Okay,
I'm,
great.
You know, I would love to be able to drive and talk, but that's good. Illegal.
Thank you very much.
So we want to play safe.
Okay, so what's your question, Mark?
Well, it's mundane. It has to do with work. It really isn't like ripping CDs or, you know, chatting on webs and that kind of a thing. It really has to do with running some DOS software that apparently could go on to what's called a USB key drive.
Okay.
Or you mean one of those little tiny USB drives?
Right, like one of these plug-in device plug types of things. And since I'm a psychologist and the software only runs in DOS, this is what the test manufacturer is suggesting to me, is to put it onto this USB plug-and-play drive, but it has to be bootable. Now, do these come of a bootable variety?
The computers would be the ones that are bootable, not the drives. But, yes, you can make a USB file bootable.
And so this has to be made. This is not going to be coming.
Well, no, you're not making a hardware change to it. Any key can be made bootable.
You want to do is you want to get your blank key. And how does it get DOS on it?
It's not simple, though.
It's really complicated.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us done it. Sean, have you ever made a bootable USB fob?
No.
Especially in DOS?
I've made bootable CDs.
Yeah, and DOS, you'd run into all sorts of problems just because it would be trying to talk to the hardware. And
it has no USB
support
in DOS. And it's just,
Well, the system would try to make it look like a drive, but
Mark, is the issue that you have the software package, which is a DOS-based software package, and you want to use it, but to do that, you'd have to have it installed somewhere. So the thought is put it on a USB drive, and then you just boot from that.
That was their thought, but I was thinking about why couldn't I just partition the hard drive?
Yeah, that's easy. That's much easier. Also, are you running a Windows machine?
Yes.
You can run this in DOS mode. I mean,
that's true.
I would do it that way.
Yeah. That would be the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
Get a DOS bootable floppy.
Or a DOS bootable floppy.
Just boot to DOS off the floppy and then run your application.
Yeah, but then the application must be on somewhere accessible.
So it sounds like we're trying to expand something, right?
How big is this application?
It's 2 megs. It's not very big at all, so.
Yeah, booting off of zip drives is actually pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
If you're using a FAT file system, you could actually place the file on your computer and access it from DOS.
Yeah, that might be the solution.
So you just boot to DOS with the floppy?
Right.
And then
here's another
the file
thought.
Anyway.
I mean, if you're pretty technical savvy, you could just grab another hard drive, or, you know, anything, really, an old one, 20-gig one or whatever. Stick it in your machine as a secondary IDE, and then in your BIOS settings when you boot your machine, just choose which drive you want to boot off of.
That makes sense.
That would be
you're saying, like, an old one, 20 gigs.
Right.
How jaded are we?
Thank you very much for the call.
It's true,
Thanks
though.
So much for your help.
A 20-gig hard drive is worthless to me now. It's worth putting
it in. Like stacking around.
It's terrible.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam. John Tracy's being kind of quiet, but he's here as well. And we're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And of the four laptops in this room, is anyone checking mail so we can actually...
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. So you can send...
It looks like the Macs can only connect today.
You can send us email via...
Those are better.
Just visit geekspeak.org, and you can click on contact us, and that email will get to us directly. We're going to take a call from a steady listener and a friend of mine, Blaze from Santa Cruz. I'm hoping this is the same Blaze. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi.
Hey.
I have a question about making sound recording on the I'm running Panther, and I've got a G3 notebook.
Okay.
And the sound port, it has a sound port. Doesn't tell me, first of all, if it's stereo or not. And what I want to do is, my uncle's getting kind of old, and he's kind of our family historian. I want to record him, so, you know, have a conversation with him. And I couldn't really find any software on the system to do that.
Yeah. Stinks, doesn't it? You got an OS X Titanium G4?
No, G3.
Oh, G3, okay.
Is it like a Wall Street or a Pismo?
It's a FireWire. It's a Pismo, I guess.
Okay. So, and you're basically, it doesn't have an audio in, right?
It has audio in.
It does have audio. Oh, nice.
Yeah, but it's just like, you know, I was thinking, well, if it has audio in, wouldn't there be some software? If you plug in a mic, you can actually record something.
Are you running OS X on it?
Yeah, I've got Panther on it.
Okay, so the application you want is called Audio In. It's a little freebie application. It's real cool. It just captures your audio source. And it's a free thing. John's doing a search on it right now to find out where it is. And it's called Audio In. If you did a search at Google and call it Audio In, uppercase I, uppercase A, not that that matters at Google, but that's
you,
what
you
it
can
is.
Also go to Apple, the Apple's download site.
Yeah.
OS X download site, and it's up there, too. And
that's like a shareware or something?
Yeah, it's freeware, actually.
Freeware. Oh,
and it's
very
a great
cool.
little app. I used to record the shows with it. It's pretty good. It does have some problems after about an hour. There like seems to be problems. But what you want to do is just record for about 20 minutes or half an hour. It's going to make an AIF file on your, I think, on your desktop or something. It's very simple. It doesn't have a lot of features, but it's perfect for what you're doing.
Perfect. And does that does my sound port, is that a stereo port or what kind
it's
of
probably stereo. I can't imagine they'd make mine mono. The only thing is Apple does have some proprietary type of mics. They've got powered mics and non-powered mics. And most Apple inputs are actually set up to be powered. So if you have, depending on the mic, you'll use it. It'll be used differently.
They switched over at some point.
Yeah, but
during there, though, to line in. Yeah, I can't remember if his FireWire G3 has line in or if it needs that special.
I think it'll probably be line in. But basically, do you have any kind of mics right now?
Yeah. Well, I have some some Shure mics that are like for doing a stage something like that. Or I have like a cheap kind of Dell mic that came with a...
Yeah, I would go ahead and... it's risky, of course, but not that risky. Go ahead and get Audio In, set it up to be recording from the audio source, and then plug in a microphone and see what happens.
Okay.
And if you can't find Audio In, there's another one called Audio X.
Yeah.
It's not freeware, it's shareware. I don't know what the fee is. It's probably not much.
Does this stuff give you any capability to, edit?
No.
No.
No,
it's
that's
it's just to be able
feature.
To capture from an external source. And then you need something like Sound Studio is my favorite.
That's what we
It's not very expensive. It's not multi-track either, but if you're just doing voice, that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can use something like iMovie.
Audio.
For audio, even.
I think there's an Audacity for OS X.
Yeah, Audacity is another good application, Audacity. Last time I checked, it wasn't great. Good luck, Blaze.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And another Dave. I think Dave is a good caller today. Well, it's a different Dave, but from Santa Cruz. Welcome, Dave.
Hey, how you doing?
Quite well.
It's a great name. Hey, listen, I had a question. If you were going to, get a couple computers to run a business, if going into a Mac application is better than PC as far as security issues, are there compatibility issues as far as...
First, look at the kind of business you're going to be going in and look at what kind of applications you're going to need and then see what the support for Mac is out there. I mean, Mac does have security through obscurity going for it. I mean, there are not nearly the amount of hacks and attacks and spyware and malware on Macs.
What kind of business are you starting?
Well, it's a renewable power clearinghouse, basically. I mean, we've been running for a while, but it's just sort of like, we're running XP right now, and it's just kind of like, I don't know. I mean...
Well, look at the applications you're running and see if they're available.
It's basically just Excel and stuff. I don't know. I've been hearing stuff about Macs a little less attackable. And
there's so much debate about this.
You've already got the machines. I mean, as long as you keep them patched and keep your antivirus stuff up to date. I mean,
right.
it's gonna be work to get everybody moved over to Mac. I mean, just because people are gonna have to learn a new thing. We kind of go with, stay with what you're in. If you didn't have anything at all, that'd be much more of a question of what to do. But you've got XP machines. You already have the hardware. You keep things patched. Get Service Pack 2 on all the machines. Get a virus protection software. And you should be okay.
All righty. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, David, for the call.
Bye.
Well, we might have room for a couple more calls. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. But while waiting, Miles, this week we had some problems with the GeekSpeak server. Let's talk about that.
Okay. By the way, DD was mentioning that it is Micrometer. So according to DD, who I'm prepared to accept.
I like Micrometer.
Yeah, Micrometer.
I like DD.
I miss you.
the server, basically what happened was a few days ago, it started pumping out a huge amount of data, which is unusual for us. Our hosting facility basically cut us off going, what's going on here? Usually you guys are at about you know, 300 kilobytes a second of sustained output. Yeah, no one ever comes to our
which is
site.
A DSL speed, kind of.
Yeah.
Right.
And
which
we
is good because yeah. their hosting is for free. And then,
right.
then the company is
right.
GNI. They have hosting services in San Jose.
Yes, and they are very capable. We're very happy.
Wonderful company. We have, yeah, great experience with them. In any case, they're hosting us for free because we're a nonprofit. Or,
and we, our server just started pumping out 60 megabits a second sustained.
Which is really, really fast. I mean, that's yeah. like office speeds,
right.
maxing out an office speed connection.
Right, which is
not
which
good.
Is not okay.
No. In fact, what he said to us was that if he didn't turn it off, it would cost him about $6,000 or $4,000 or something like that a month at that rate. That's how much bandwidth costs, if you will.
Yeah.
So he didn't want us to be doing that because it'd be out of his pocket and, you know.
Yeah, although, to his credit, he was basically concerned about the fact that it looked like our box was taken over. And
which is probably what happened.
It's probably what happened. We don't know for sure. We still have to do some forensics on it. Our, you know, our resident network engineer, John, is going to be
taking a look.
Taking a look. But, basically, we're going off the assumption that we were hacked. So basically what we had to do was we brought... we took the machine down.
Well, first we took all the services down. We said, okay, let's turn off the web service to make sure that it's not that people are just listening to a lot of GeekSpeak shows, because that's a possibility that all right. of a sudden GeekSpeak just, you know, I want every copy of GeekSpeak ever made. And we have like 2.5 years, something like that, of GeekSpeak shows online at geekspeak.org in MP3 form, and they're not small. They're like 4 megs a piece.
Great.
Like
now we're going to
piece.
Have a whole bunch.
Yeah. Here's a spike. But in any case, so the first concern was that someone was just hitting a lot of the traffic. That wasn't the case, though. We turned off web and nothing happened.
Right. We turned off all the services and basically it was still spitting out more data than it should have been.
Well, with all the services down, it should be spitting out nothing, basically.
Basically. Nominal. Just the amount for us to communicate to the server.
Well, what I find interesting on this, just to bring it back to people's homes and such, we're still running a Linux machine, and people normally are running Windows machines that have problems of this nature. But Windows and Unix machines can be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in fact, our server was making it fairly easy in that we hadn't been very diligent with our security patches.
And actually, security patches also are passwords. We're not enforcing strict password protocols. So people might have a password of their, you know, dog's name, cat, you know, some simple name, which is a really easy attack to do.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, someone obviously, well, we think at this point, it's theory, broke into the machine and started using it for something, maybe spamming, maybe sharing files. We're not sure. But the bandwidth went through the roof, and we had to turn it off.
Right. So we had taken the server down. Went over there with a new hard drive that we had installed a new installation, because basically once a system has been hacked, it's going to be suspect, because you may have programs in there that someone has put in as a Trojan horse that right. is just going to open up a hole again or allow them access.
And unlike a Windows machine, on a Unix machine, when it's a hack, we've got a server kind of situation. There are so many different types of what's called rootkits, different ways of making the machine owned by someone else, if you will, that it's just not something you can scan for. So we decided to do a full clean install.
Well, you can, but it's hard.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we put in a new hard drive, new installation, and been steadily bringing it back up again and trying to look at the conversations. Or look at the configuration, sorry, of the old server to be able to copy them over. But you don't want to copy them over all at once. You want to look and see, make sure the things haven't been changed, and change things one at a time. And it's fairly laborious. We ended up getting out of there at, what, midnight?
Something yeah, like we got left about midnight. That's right.
Yeah.
And we got it. We got the mail back up.
Let's yes, see. And now we can get mail again. And we got the site back up again yesterday.
A lot of work. It was down for a couple of days. But geekspeak.com, or geekspeak.org, excuse me, is back up. And, Miles, I really want to thank you for that. And, Sean, for the hardware support. Thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. No, I'll do that in a few minutes. We're going to take another call from Garland. I think this is going to be our last call today. Garland from Monterey, welcome back to GeekSpeak.
Howdy, guys.
What's your question?
It's about cell phones. One of your favorite subjects, I think.
Yummy.
I'm thinking of switching companies, and I'm trying... I don't know if you guys can give opinions on particular...
Sure, we have opinions.
Oh, great, okay.
We have lots of those.
Okay, well, I'm thinking of going from... I'm with Singular now, and I'm thinking about switching to Verizon, mainly because of the ability to stay in touch with family if you're on Verizon networks and not use your minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to think, is that... Other than that, is it worth it? Are they a good company, et cetera?
Too bad John's just walked out because...
Verizon versus Singular versus AT&T Wireless, the people that I know that are on them, they're all fairly interchangeable. In fact, AT&T Wireless is owned by Singular now, so, or vice versa.
No, Singular. No, you're Singular.
Right. But since you have family members that are on Verizon already, I guess it makes sense for you because then you'll be able to talk with them for free. Far be it from us to dissuade someone from calling mom.
I have AT&T Singular, and I found that my coverage up in the mountains is much better with it.
Yeah, I think AT&T has better coverage than San Jose Valley, but you're in Monterey. So
but especially over GSM.
That's true.
I've heard that Verizon was doing better than AT&T.
Verizon does really good up in the hills, but there's CDMA.
Really?
And your phone choices are limited, as I'm finding out right now.
So did you just switch over to CDMA, or you switch over to something, John?
No, I have Verizon, and I have a dead phone, or a phone that's working on being a dead phone. And I'm looking for a new phone that's also compatible with my Mac. And I've got, like, two phones to choose from to stick with Verizon and stick with
poor
Mac.
Guy, yeah. So,
And T-Mobile is great for wireless stuff, but it has horrible coverage.
Horrible coverage. Okay, so Verizon's pretty good on the coverage. Are they good on the Internet on the wireless stuff?
Verizon?
Yeah.
What are you trying to do with it? I'm sorry, I was out.
Well, mainly I'm trying to switch to the company. I'm trying to see what I can use it for other than just my family.
Well, T-Mobile has support at Starbucks and a bunch of other.
Yeah, it's great if you're in a metropolitan area.
Yeah.
If you're near the coastlines, it's.
But you pay. It's not part of your cellular fee. You have to pay extra.
Although the prices
are
like
that, though.
Yeah.
The prices are coming down because I know AT&T is going after T-Mobile right now. So AT&T and Singular have started this price war, and T-Mobile is also starting to drop their prices. So the price for wireless web connection is coming down. But connectivity over on the coast, as Miles is saying, is kind of spotty.
Not that great. But cell phone service coverage is pretty good, though.
I don't know about for T-Mobile.
No, I don't think it is that good. For Verizon?
Verizon's excellent.
Yes. Verizon is excellent. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to have to cut you off. Thank you very much for the call.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys.
Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland, The Geeks Today, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and Miles Elam. Thank you all for making Geek Speak what it is.
You're welcome.
To those that called in, there were a lot today. We didn't even get to everybody. Thank you very much for calling in, participating in Geek Speak. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KDBH San Aldo, or on the web at KUSP.org. Coming up next is Open Road, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. For KUSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Now in some NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The head of cybersecurity matters at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has resigned. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Amit Yoren has announced he's quitting his job as head of computer security issues at the Department of Homeland Security just 1 year after he was appointed to the position.